Drive on Sunday, July 22nd at 2 p.m. You are listening to KPFT Houston.
Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio with our host from Children at Risk, Chief Operating Officer Dr. Katie McConnell, and policy expert Mandy Kimball. What do we have on tap today, Katie and Mandy?
Hello, hello. Thanks, Don. How are you, Katie?
I'm so great, Mandy. Thank you. How are you today?
Wonderful. Happy Monday. I'm so glad you could join us today.
I'm thrilled. I'm sorry that Dr. Bob couldn't be here, but I'm thrilled to be here. This is a good way to wrap up my first day back post-vacation. I know you're kind of in the same boat I am.
Oh, that's right. I think there's a lot of people in the same boat.
That decided, you know, with the 4th of July in the middle of the week, so take as much time as we can.
Let's maximize that opportunity.
That's great. And I felt that in traffic this morning, too. I was grateful for that. Some people were maybe moving slow today.
Well, we hope that everyone had a fantastic 4th of July. Fireworks are always fun, but it's usually an opportunity to get together with family and friends. And
that's
so
right.
Hope everyone was safe and enjoyed the quality time. So today, we're going to start off the show with Children at Risk Project Coordinator with the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation, Patrick Gill, and he's going to talk about the significance of the number 33,000.
I'm a little disappointed I didn't get any sneak peek on this today, so I have no idea where Patrick is going to take us
You'll
with this
surprised.
Number, but I'm sure it'll be great. Patrick's a pretty smart guy.
That's right. Stay tuned
That's
and find
right.
out.
And then after Datahead, we'll be talking to Kate Unger. She is from one of my favorite places in the city of Houston, and that is the Houston Zoo.
Hmm.
And Kate will be talking and sharing information about summer camps and educational programs that the zoo offers to give kids a chance to get up close and personal with the animal kingdom.
You gotta love the animal kingdom.
Neat. So many awesome programs there.
There are. And after that, we're going to have our good friend Frances DeVinny from the Center for Public Policy Priorities, and she's going to be joining us and breaking down the latest kids count data that was recently released and tell us about how children are doing in Texas.
There's a lot to learn there. That report is very comprehensive.
It's a lot of data, a lot of good stuff. Information you see, not always so great.
Right.
But let's chat about it. What's
That's
going
right.
on?
Well, still, it's still important to know. And then, of course, we'll have our social conscience scale where we ask our listeners to call in and share their opinion on thumbs up and thumbs up, thumbs down. And today we're going to be talking about if handwriting and cursive should be mandatory in elementary schools. It's a hot topic. I don't know.
It is.
I'll be curious.
What's interesting is that most states do not require handwriting.
That's right.
Or cursive. And where's the accountability? Or do we even need it, right? Is technology
moving forward? I was going to say in today's modern technology, and I can't believe I'm admitting it. we'll see.
So we look forward to hearing from our listeners. And then our final guest today will be Jill Campbell, Managing Immigration with Baker Ripley. She's the Managing Immigration Attorney at Baker Ripley, joining us to talk about what's happening on the ground in our region as the zero tolerance policy and the impact it's having on families. So this is what we're talking about, separating families, zero tolerance on crossing and coming into Texas.
That's right. I know there are probably a lot of people want to call in response to that as well. It continues to be a hot topic. We just had, this past weekend, we had an op-ed published in the Chronicle from Children at Risk with some of our staff that's really working with the idea of immigrant children to say we've got to continue to be the voice for these kids. We've got to get families together sooner rather than later. So it'll be great to hear some of the work that the folks at Baker Ripley are doing to help kids as well.
That's right. We are going to have a fantastic show today. Welcome to Growing Up in America on KPFT Houston Pacifica Radio, a discussion on our children, public policy, politics, and our future. And how do we as a nation do when it comes to taking care of all of our kids? Every week we aim to fill the same 58 minutes with a lively discussion on the status of children in America from experts on the quality of life for America's children. I am Mandy Kimball, and today we have Katie McConnell joining.
I'm present. Happy to be here.
That's right. So, you know, we have been having fun during the week of 4th of July, fireworks, family fun. But the reality is that there's still a lot of work being done this summer, right?
That's right.
And particularly around interim hearings. So at the state capitol, even though it's not the legislative session, there have been a lot of conversations around school finance, which is good. And then last week, there was also, I guess it was a week and a half ago, on mental health, which was extremely timely, and talking to toxic stress. And what's going on, and just a couple of examples, right? Well, there's always been toxic stress that our kids are growing up with, and how can our teachers or school professionals or whoever they're surrounded by identify them,
right?
See the red flags, but then also help support the services that they need. And so really look forward to these conversations continuing.
It's exciting just to hear the conversations are being had right now.
Right.
You know, we haven't let it drop yet. And we know so many kids, especially along the Gulf Coast, are going to be still experiencing different things after this last school year and the storm.
That's right.
Teachers are going to continue to need to really be in tune to that side of things. So it's good to hear the legislature's continuing these conversations.
Yep. So I encourage listeners to pay attention to those conversations. I do thank Governor Abbott for making this a priority and helping to support those conversations. And I look forward to keeping our listeners up to date on how those conversations go. But are you ready for Data Head?
Of course I'm ready for Data Head.
So today we have Patrick Gill with the Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation. How are you doing today, Patrick?
I'm great. How are you, Andy?
Great. Happy Monday.
To you as well.
Great. And so the number you have for us, give it to us.
So my number is 33,000.
33,000. Okay.
And that is the number of refugees that the U.S. resettled in 2017 from around the world, which might on its face sound like a lot, but it's actually the fewest refugees the U.S. has resettled since 9/11. And it is last year, 2017, was the first time in history that the rest of the world resettled more refugees than the U.S. did. We've traditionally been the world leader in resettling refugees, and that changed in 2017.
That's
really settled our fewest in almost 20 years.
That's really an interesting number, Patrick. So let's dive a little bit deeper there. So what's the implication here? What does this mean, especially for kids?
Well, for kids, it means that families that are in, areas of conflict or are coming from people have been displaced from their homes. A refugee is, by definition, somebody that's been displaced from their home country. And this drop in the U.S. Resettlement of refugees comes at the same time that the global refugee population reached historic highs of almost 20 million people. So there are almost 20 million women, children, dads around the world that have left their home countries because it was unsafe and are looking for other countries to take them in. And at the same time that's happening, we cut our resettlement by almost two-thirds.
So the U.S. Refugee Act passed in 1980, right? And Texas historically has led the world in resettlement. So when we talk about it, more than half of the resettled refugees oftentimes came to America. Is correct, Patrick? Is my understanding
almost,
of this situation.
Since 1980, almost3/4 of global refugees.
Wow. There we go. More than half.
That's amazing.
And so as the refugee population is increasing, resettlement is decreasing. Let's talk a little bit about that. Why is that the case? Why are they going in? Is it because there are so many that it's hard to process them? Are states making it more difficult or not opening their doors as much as they used to? Is crime enhancing?
Well, so refugee resettlement is ultimately a federal decision because refugees don't actually enter the country, their new home countries, until they've gone through really serious vetting process. Like there's a there's a long security process to make sure that they are safe before they can even enter. So there's a distinction here between refugees and undocumented immigrants or asylum seekers who enter their destination country before receiving approval. Refugees have to go through a really long and arduous process before they can even come into their country, the country that they'll be resettling in. So, and that process happens for the federal government. You can see that there was a big change from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. In 2016, the U.S. resettled almost 100,000 refugees, and then it was only 33,000 in 2017. And we are on pace to continue those record lows in 2018.
That's interesting. So it sounds like it's just becoming more difficult to go through the process, I assume, to be able to be resettled.
Well, I think that there's, you know, there were some concerns raised during the 2016 campaign about the security, actually was. So I think that's some of it. And I do think you're right that because there are 20 million refugees around the world, it just, at some point it's difficult to work with all of them. That's such a huge population of people we have to sift through, and that process is pretty intensive. So it becomes difficult to process and get them through into the U.S. or to other countries as well.
Right. I know one of our guests later is going to be talking a little bit about the family separation and the situation mm-hmm. on our border. A lot of conversation has been had as of late, the difference between a refugee and an asylee. And I think it's important for everyone to understand that those are very different political terms and they require very different things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll see how this all plays out.
That's right. We'll see, right?
All right, Patrick. Well, thank you very much. And did you have a nice 4th of July last week?
Yeah, it was great. Once the flooding went down, we went to a friend's place who had a view of downtown. So we watched the fireworks from their balcony. It was really nice.
Well, that's good.
Very great.
Good deal. Well, thank you very much. Patrick Gill with Children at Risk Center for Social Measurement and Evaluation, always keeping an eye on the data and the latest
right.
trends. So thanks for calling in and sharing. Take care.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Bye, Patrick.
Bye-bye.
So much to think about. So many numbers.
It is.
So much meaning.
But, you know, but I was reading also that even though the number of refugees that have resettled in America, we're still one of the top nations that are resettling refugees. So, you know, it's just all really interesting. And it can get confusing,
it
right?
Can
what
get
is this
confused.
Word or that
That's
word?
Right.
And what are the implications? I think we're all still trying to figure that out. As
That's
well.
Right. Yep. We absolutely are. And trying to do our best that we can, right?
Right?
Do the best that we can. So, yeah. So much to see and do in this world. Next on the line, we have our first guest. What a great intro song. Sometimes I feel like, Mandy, you could use that as your intro song. Where the wild things are. Sometimes our office is like that. On the line, we have Kate Unger from the Houston Zoo. Kate, are you there?
I am. Hello, hello.
Hello. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you all today?
We are great. Thank you.
Now, are the animals, do they love the rain? Is it
they
refreshing?
Do.
I mean,
they
it's
do.
Hot. Houston, it is hot.
It is hot.
Like, very nice. Thank you for the break.
They you enjoy know, it. That's true.
It's funny. We had an interesting conversation, actually, with our staff this morning about fears that kids have sometimes. It's just like our energizer. And somebody mentioned birds, and I remember going to the Houston Zoo as a kid, and my mom also was terrified of birds, but there was always a nice relief when you could go into the bird house, I don't know what you call it, because mm-hmm. it was the one place that had air conditioning at the zoo. And I remember being a little kid and no understanding that the only reason my mom was willing to go there was because of the AC.
Make the difference.
And they're secure.
And they're secure, right?
I get you.
Which she didn't necessarily find comfort in. But so, Kate, I know you guys through the years have developed countless programs to serve kids across the community. Can you start just by telling us about some of the summer camps and educational and volunteer opportunities that you guys have?
Sure thing. Absolutely. So we do have a pretty extensive summer camp for kids to 4 to 13 years old, and even a little bit older than that as well. We are sold out for this summer, so we have a great camp program that sells out every year. And it's a great opportunity for kids to come to the zoo, see it in a different light, really get a hands-on experience with some animals that they get to meet every day, talking with keepers and our staff, and get to see the zoo in a really fun way, maybe a little bit different than a normal visit with their family or something like that. So camp is always a lot of fun. We also have fall and winter camp opportunities that are just the day programs rather than a full week of camp that a lot of families try out for maybe first-time campers or something like that. And then volunteer opportunities, we have a vast array of volunteers at the zoo, and that information is all online. There's different seasons of applications and interviews that go on for that. So I think there's probably an application up now for the fall or winter volunteers on the website. If people are interested, they can feel free to check it out.
So the Houston Zoo is fantastic.
It is fantastic.
And, it's so generous in regards to scholarships and evenings that everyone can enjoy as a family going to the zoo. But, Kate, how does the Houston Zoo compare to the other zoos around America?
I may be a little bit biased.
And we are, too, so that's great. Okay.
But this is the opportunity to say we're kind of the best.
Right. We're kind of pretty awesome. We're pretty great. Yeah, we see over 2.5 million guests in our gates every single year. So that's a huge number. I think we're second to only San Diego. So for the size of zoo that we are in the city of Houston, we're one of the number one cultural attractions in the city. So up there with like the rodeo, things like that, that people get to see every year. So the zoo is right up there. We do a lot for community engagement and getting folks involved with the wildlife in their backyard and even some wildlife that you might not be used to seeing, like in Borneo or Africa. So bringing some of that a little bit closer to home and getting guests a chance to see that wildlife a little bit closer and realize what they can do to help save animals nearby, but also across the world as well.
That's so important. I also love that your programs, you even have like programs for little babes as young as 18 months old. What a great opportunity to expose them.
Yeah, our Zoo Sprouts program is fantastic. So we start them real young at the zoo, as young as, like you said, 18 months old, up to about 4 or 5 for our Zoo Sprouts program. And you can kind of think of that program as like a stroller club where kids come with their favorite adults and they get to spend an hour touring the zoo with one of our education coordinators and seeing some animals up close and personal, getting to meet a few ambassadors. And they're all really fun programs, lots of playing and games and just some fun times involved for a family to spend time at the zoo together.
I kind of feel that is the sweet spot. I've been going to the Houston Zoo for several years. I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old sons. Mm-hmm. But stroller, 18 months, 1 year, 2 years, I feel is a sweet spot because they're contained.
They're contained.
They are extremely interested in what is going on.
Of course.
But they're not really going to walk all over. After that, it's still fun, but then they have to walk and then they're running and then they get tired and then you're holding them.
And then you're even hotter because it's 120 degrees outside.
But then that's when the conversation starts.
That's right.
Right. And that's why I love the Houston Zoo membership, because you feel like you can go in for an hour or two and call it a day.
And it's
you don't
okay,
have
right?
it, you're like, no, I must stay longer.
Maximize the investment.
That's right.
But I also love one of my other favorite things at the zoo is the petting mm-hmm. zoo area. And again, that's something that kids as young, maybe not 18 months, because they might like sit in like stuff anyway, but like the younger kids to even your 9-year-old would still enjoy the opportunity to go in and experience that.
Yeah, get up and close and personal with a goat. Who doesn't love that?
Right?
That's right.
So much fun.
So these animal encounters, how do people learn more about that, Kate?
Yeah. So our animal encounters are opportunities for guests to really go behind the scenes and get an in-depth experience with a specific section. So sea lions or elephants or gorillas or giraffes, you name it, we most likely have an encounter for it. So the pricing for those depends on the type of encounter and what all is included. But all of that information is on our website, but it's basically a behind-the-scenes experience where the guest has some really in-depth time with the animals and the keepers, get to ask all the questions you've ever wanted to know about that animal and leave an expert with some great memories as well.
That sounds so fun. Why do I want to do that for myself?
It's okay to do it for yourself.
Because you do. They're great experiences.
I do. That sounds like so much fun. And so during the school year as well, you guys also have a lot of programs, a variety of programs as well.
Yeah, for sure. So during the school year, like I said earlier, we have our fall and winter camps during those school holidays, but we also have once monthly family programs as well. And those meet usually off ground. So we meet at different green spaces and parks around the city to encourage parents and families to get outdoors and explore the green spaces in Houston that might not be the zoo, but are still wonderful places to go and see local nature nearby. And then we have some new family adventure programs, too, which are just a little bit more in-depth. So if you wanted to try fishing or kayaking but maybe not have the expertise to do it on your own, you can come with us and we can do it together. And then hopefully the families will want to continue on that exploration route and do those activities again on their own once they have the confidence to do so and know where to go.
Right, and know where to go. That's important.
Yep.
You know,
know where to park, yep, right. Where to go, things like that.
The basics. You know, when we first had you call in, Kate, I very clearly proclaimed my love for the Houston Zoo. I think it's grown even more talking to you.
Oh, good.
I mean, I had some idea about some of these programs, but really, I didn't know all of the details. So thanks so much.
That's right. Well, and it's a great opportunity to interact. So you have schools who are teaching science, you're teaching biology, animals, anatomy, whatever. And all the field trips that go there are fantastic. And for homeschoolers as well, there's a great opportunity that they can reach out and go over there and learn as a group.
Yeah, we have our homeschool programs twice each month. So we offer the same topic twice during the month so that more participants can get into that program. But they're pretty extensive. They're two-hour programs where the families come to learn as a unit. We see some animals, do a front-of-scenes tour, activities, hands-on science experiments, things like that. And all of that information for our fall homeschool family program, Zoo Sprouts, is all going to be coming up on the website the next couple weeks or so through early August. We should have all of that up on the registration for the website.
That's great.
And is it too soon to start talking about zoo lights? Am I putting that?
I mean, I know we just got past the 4th of July.
Everyone
but
knows. That's great. Well, thank you, Kate. Kate Unger from the Conservation Education Team at the Houston Zoo. It's been wonderful talking with you. Thanks for all that you do for our community. Appreciate you.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, absolutely.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye, Kate.
Bye.
It's wonderful. The Houston Zoo, you're never too old for the Houston
Zoo. Absolutely not. My father-in-law
has a membership just for him, and he's the one that will go, like, I don't know, when they feed him, like the members pass.
Awesome.
Let's go at 7 o'clock in the morning and feed the animals.
To get that more.
I'm like, you have 9 grandchildren, but is he knocking on anyone's door?
Nope. Of course not. That's his, like, solitude time right there.
Whatever
with the animals.
Works. That's great. All right. So up next, we have a fantastic guest. That's a good one. Dr. Francis DeVinny, the Chief Operating Officer with the Center for Public Policy Priorities. How are you doing, Francis?
Doing great. How are you doing?
Great. Good to hear your voice. It's been a while.
Great to hear from you, too. Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us. So the Center for Public Policy Priorities is just a wealth of knowledge in so many areas, from food insecurity to poverty to immigration to education. Really, the data that y'all pull together and the analysis that educates the community and public officials is a great asset and huge value to the state of Texas. So I just want to start off by saying thank you very much there.
Thank you. And we couldn't actually have any kind of the impact that we do without great partners like Children at Risk. So thank you so much.
You are so kind. But y'all just came out with a new report, the annual Kids Count. Talk to us, Frances. How are Texas children doing?
They're doing better, but that's a low bar that they were being compared to, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So kids are doing better on a whole bunch of measures, but they're still not doing great. We are considered, Texas kids are 43rd, with 50 being the worst, 43rd in well-being compared to all the other states.
There is a lot of movement there for growth, opportunity
yes,
for growth.
Opportunities for growth. I was going to say 43rd. You know, that's where, but I lose the words. I mean, to think the amount of work, the amount of dollars, the amount of kids that we have here, the amount of, they need yep. so much. How are we still okay. in this situation?
You know what's shocking is that one of every 10 kids in the United States is a Texan.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do for kids in this state is going to affect not only how well the state does economically, socially, but it's also going to impact the well-being of the United States as a whole.
That's
what
right.
Texas does kind of drives the country.
Right. We know everything is big in Texas, but we use that stat quite a bit, Francis. We're not just talking about Texas children, 1 in 10 children in America. And so when we look at it, and what were we before? You said we have improved. What were we, 48th before?
Well,
in the past?
Sadly, here's the tricky part about data. Our ranking hasn't really improved. We've kind of uh-huh. hovered around 42nd, 43rd for the last several years.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look at the individual pieces of data that go into how we got that ranking,
okay.
we've actually gotten better in a few areas. So I'll give you a couple of examples. So we've actually gotten better in the percentage of kids who live in poverty. So it used to be about 1 in 4. Now it's about 1 in 5. Mm-hmm. A little bit of better, but mm-hmm. that's still a lot of kids,
still
right?
A lot
about
of kids,
1.6
but...
million kids.
There we go. And poverty, we're not talking about near poverty, but living in poverty, which is how much for a family of four?
About $24,000 for a family of four.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And to think that still 1 in 5 children
mm-hmm.
are
yes.
living in that scenario.
Right.
Yeah, and actually one of the things that, separate from this report that we look at, is how much it actually costs to make ends meet. And for a two-parent family that where both parents work, they need to make well above minimum wage just to have the basic needs covered, a car that's paid off, a rent on an apartment that's kind of an average rent, never eating out, all of those basics, and you still need to make double minimum wage.
Double. Living wage, right? You need
right.
a living wage,
you
which is
You need a living
double.
Wage. That's the right way to put it.
There we go. And then how is children's health?
You know, kids' health is actually kind of hovering a little bit. So we have seen some improvements over the last 6-7 years on health insurance, was a really, really important, because in this economy, how do you get health care? You go through your insurance to get to a doctor, most of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so health insurance is critically important. We've seen huge improvements in that, but we're still tied for the second worst state for having the number and percentage of kids who are uninsured. And so right now we have about 1 in every 11 kids does not have health insurance.
Okay.
In terms of low birth weight babies, we've kind of stayed about the same. Teen death, we've kind of stayed about the same. So we're kind of hovering on some things, and the only things that have gotten better have been driven by the federal government, not by the state.
There we go. Now, Frances, these are issues that we've talked about for a long time. I've known you for well over a decade.
That's
right.
Right. Oh, don't
wait, so y'all met in fourth grade.
Yes,
good,
that's true.
Good.
And our parents were talking about that before.
That's right.
But I feel that the data has consistently been there. I feel that the message of what this means, how it impacts our children's health, what it does in regards to education and the workforce and the future, these are conversations that have continued to happen. And I feel like over, the past 10, 15 years, we have gained some steps in the right direction. And then we've seen it go backwards, 3 or 4. What is it looking like right now in regards to, yay, we're improving? It's still not good. No one
right.
can say any of this is good. What are the reasons of why we are where we are right now?
It's such an important question. And actually, where we've seen improvement is where we've put our time and attention and resources. So one of the things we talk about at the Center for Public Policy Priorities is you invest where you put your priorities, and kids are not where we're putting our priorities. Now, if you look at, for example, the state budget is primarily taken up with health care coverage for our elderly population, a little bit of health care coverage for our kids, and public education. So you might look at that and say, well, actually, we pretty much focus on our kids. It's not that our that the percentage of the budget is focused in the wrong place. It's that we keep cutting back the size of that pie. Our pie is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and while the percentage may stay the same, the amount of money we have going towards a continually growing public school population, a continually growing child population that needs access to health care, continues to shrink. And we cannot, in a time when an economy continues to boom and we're seeing rising prices, not too bad, but, you know, inflation does exist, we have to keep pace with that, or what kids are getting in terms of support and services to be their best selves is dwindling year by year.
Explained very well.
Well, yeah, and I just think about when we look at the money that is allocated to our public school system, and that on, I mean, since the early 1990s, the discussion we've been having in Texas to figure out, you know, if we're making this investment, how are we doing it? How are we doing it equitably and making sure that works? And we haven't figured it out yet.
We haven't. And
that's
the state
terrifying.
Has actually made a commitment. They've got a commission going on right now, looking at, you know, are we going to do a study on how much it actually costs for kids to get a good quality education in Texas? That study hasn't been done yet. There's still some discussion about it, but it would be a step in the right direction to figure out, you know, mm-hmm. are we actually doing enough? And I would venture to guess, based on what we're seeing in terms of outcomes on test scores and outcomes compared to kids in other states, that we're probably not, and there's something we could do.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it gets frustrating. Last year, there's been several years, right? The state school district sued the state saying, hey, you need to pay more into it. And the legislature had an opportunity last session, decided not to. They created a commission to talk mm-hmm. more about, are we mm-hmm. funding our school system enough? We know we're not, right? We know that we are not. And do we need a study to say how much it should be, or should we act
right
now? That's the question. And I think, you know, Frances, you've had many of these conversations. We need to invest in our priorities, right? That's
yep.
what people do. It's
right.
not currently happening. And I think where we struggle as advocates sometimes is on the philosophical debate, right? On pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
Oh, yeah.
Let's take care of our own. We're taking care of ours. Do you think that the mind, the thinking has changed a little bit, or that we're still on that path?
I think one of the reasons we're clinging to that notion so badly as a society is that it is dwindling away. That's my optimistic hope.
There we go.
The one thing I like to say about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is, if you've ever actually like laid down with a pair of boots on, you cannot pull yourself up by pulling on the tops of those little tabs on your boots. You can't do it. It's a false narrative. You have to have somebody lean down and give you a hand to
yep.
get you up. Or you haul yourself up, but
you
the bootstraps don't work, so it's a false narrative.
And you have
we
to have
always
boots.
Have somebody else helping us.
Well, right, no, actually, you say that jokingly, Mandy, that is true. Some don't even have the boots, access to the boots
yep.
to pull themselves up by said bootstraps. So
right.
what do we do then?
That's true. No, that's
great.
That's
exactly right. Yeah, I'm hoping that we are coming to a realization, particularly in this time in this country when we are starting to pull away from our allies, that being in isolation, whether in a country or in a state or in a city or in an individual's household or an individual, you just see that you can't do it. You can't do it alone. And there is no kid out there, whether how well off they are or how much in need they are, that doesn't need a hand from somebody else.
That's right. It takes a village or a community
really
or a state or a system,
whatever it is.
That's right.
Effective, though. We need it to
effective.
Be effective.
Oh,
yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can you talk about, we know that the 2020 census is coming
yeah.
up, and there have it. It's amazing. Some people are really talking about it. Others are like, I don't really care, or don't realize the significance or the importance that it has on Texas and our children. Can you speak a little bit of why? I know the Center for Public Policy Priorities has a focus in trying to move things forward to make sure there's an accurate count. Why is that important?
There's several reasons why it's really important, and I hope your listeners kind of take this to heart. The first one is, you know, as we said just a minute ago, everything's bigger in Texas, including our population. And if we don't get an accurate count, we could lose representation in Congress, or at least not gain the seats that we need to get because our population is booming.
Mm-hmm.
So when we do that count, they figure out, oh, Texas has grown. We need three, four, five new representatives going to Congress. That means Texas has a bigger voice. That means we get to have more impact because we have more people. Bad count, no voice, right?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So that's one. Two, there are hundreds of millions of dollars that come back to Texas because of the data that's collected in the census. And people might say, oh, that's going to big corporations. It doesn't affect me. Actually, a lot of that money goes to the roads you drive on every day, goes to construction, goes to shoring up bridges, goes to kind of protection things. It goes to public schools in forms of grants. There's all these kinds of things that we don't realize are being affected by the resources that we're getting from the federal government, and the data in the census is how they determine whether or not we get money or we get a certain amount of money based on our population.
So we know it's important. I wish it could be as easy as, okay, we're going to have an accurate count. But there are some concerns, right, that it won't.
Yeah.
One, is there a real desire to have an accurate account? And two, are people willing to step up and do the survey?
I was going to say put their name on the paper.
Put their name on the piece of paper. I mean, Texas, mm-hmm. for so many reasons, we're a great state. And one of it is diversity, right?
Yeah.
But there are some people who are concerned and don't feel safe, and therefore that's just one more hurdle that we're going to have to overcome to get the numbers.
I don't think we can shy away from the fact that, you know, personal information has been used against U.S. citizens in the past,
mm-hmm,
right? In World War II in particular. A lot of people think about the Japanese internment camps. I don't think we can back away from that. What we can say is that because of that horrific time period, new laws have come in place that explicitly prohibit the sharing of any individual information from the Census Bureau. So they are absolutely from the president to any particular department head or anyone in the cabinet, any state official, they are prohibited from sharing individual information and can be sent to jail if they do so. So, you know, there are really strict laws in place right now to protect every individual's information. That said, you're exactly right. There's a new question that they're taking public comments on right now, but has been included in the Census Bureau and is being, they're planning on putting it in, that asks whether or not a person is a citizen of the United States. Doesn't ask if they're undocumented, meaning like mm-hmm. that they're here without specific papers. So somebody who says they're not a citizen could be here with a green card, they could be here with specific documentation, or they could be undocumented, either one. But that makes people nervous, right?
Of course it does. And we can certainly see why. Frances, thank you so much for calling in today. You've shared so much information. If people want to learn more or look up the report that we were speaking about, where can they go to get more information?
Well, there's two places I'd send them to. One is datacenter.kidscount.org. That's where you can get all of the fantastic information at the state level for Texas, as well as for all 254 counties in Texas. Check out that website. You can also go to CPPP, that's 3Ps, .org, to learn more about what we're doing around the census and more about what's going on with kids.
There we go. Thank you very much,
thank
Frances
so
Devaney
much.
With Center for Public Policy Priorities. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon, Frances.
Thank you. Take care.
Great. Thanks.
So much good information. I just love it. Like, my wheels are just spinning. I could have talked to her all afternoon.
I know. Great resource.
She always
great
has
partner.
So much good stuff
it's
to
great.
Share.
So are you ready?
I am so ready, Mandy.
Yeah.
Yeah, we know what that music means. I tried to nail that move Dr. Bob always does when he's in here, and that was such an epic fail. I'm a little bit embarrassed right
were
now.
Were you trying? It didn't sound like you were trying, Station.
I was, well, okay. I know. Okay. I just, you're only as sick as your secrets, right?
Okay.
I wanted to confess that to the listeners. We know that that means it's time for our social conscience scale, where we take timely and newsworthy items and comment on them via our social conscience scale with thumbs up or thumbs down. We encourage everyone to call in and weigh in on the issue by dialing 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. But remember, Mandy, no fence sitting.
No fence sitting.
And today's topic.
Should handwriting and cursive be mandatory in elementary schools?
What?
I guarantee you that there are several people who are saying, well, it already is.
Right.
That's not really
but that's
the
not
case,
actually
right?
the case. And, you know, this has, we talk about it being timely, the state of Ohio, or Ho-Hi-Ho, as my five-year-old niece was calling it that I was visiting last week. It was her, that's how she cheered for fireworks. Anyway, they have just passed a bill requiring the State Board of Education to create a cursive curriculum for kindergarten through fifth grade students. Several other states like Tennessee and California have also added cursive to the standards. The Common Core, however, which dictates what many states do across the country, does not require teaching students in cursive. But, alas, there's Texas. We do require that teaching in Texas.
There we go. All right. So should handwriting and cursive be mandatory in elementary schools? 713-526-5738. 713-526-5738. I know that I was taught handwriting in cursive.
Absolutely.
My parents and pretty much everyone beyond that, right. Before that.
That was
a thing, right?
Absolutely.
But times have changed.
Yes, they
There's
have.
More technology. There's the Common Core, No Child Left Behind. Let's really get to it, which left it out, right?
It did, because there was so much other stuff.
There's other stuff.
Just crammed
in. Plus now we need to know how to type quickly.
That's right.
And really, who writes anymore? So when you have to set priorities.
I do. I'm raising my hand here in the studio. Write? You can't see, but yes, I do. I write a lot.
Do you? Good job.
My preferred method. It sticks more in my brain.
You're revealing your age.
I am.
A little bit.
Just call me Mama.
There's not a lot of people.
But I'm a visual learner, right? So typing it on a keyboard is very different for me than if I handwrite a note to myself.
Yeah.
And I also think, too, just like the sentiment of a handwritten note, not like a, like, hey, Mandy, make sure you get this done note, but a thank you note or whatever is also so powerful that I know a lot of kids can't even do.
Nope, it's true. So Common Core doesn't require it. So the majority of states actually don't require it. But
that's
now
right.
We're seeing it for over a decade, right? For many years, it hasn't been in the elementary schools. Now there are some states who are passing legislation saying, okay, no, actually, elementary schools, you have to practice handwriting.
That's right.
We want cursive by fifth grade. Let's go. Texas is not part of the Common Core.
No,
right?
They're not.
And
never
so some people agree, some people do not. But let's talk about the reality. Now, just because we're not a part of it and we have standards that say you have to have handwriting and cursive, is there any accountability? Is it actually happening?
So I would say no. There's no real
Dr. Katie McConnell, who is a former principal.
So no. There is a lot of people do that because it's something that they are passionate about. But I would say in general in schools, it's something that's oftentimes pushed aside because the bottom line is it's not going to be on STAR.
Okay.
I will say there's some element of that when kids get to fourth grade, for example, and they start taking, they have to do the written portion of the STAR where they have to write a story or an essay. If one of the raters can't read it, there's no way that they would get the score that perhaps they deserve if it's their handwriting's not legible. But that doesn't motivate a lot of people very much.
Very interesting. Okay.
It is.
So we have John on the phone. John, how are you doing?
Good.
Great. Thanks for calling. Are you thumbs up or thumbs down to handwriting and cursive being mandatory in elementary schools? What'd you say?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. All right. Did you know that it wasn't being taught?
I've heard that they were going to stop doing it, and I'm actually in Texas, so I have a 9-year-old, and I heard that they were trying to stop cursive writing.
Yep.
John, how is your 9-year-old's handwriting? You don't have to reveal all of your family secrets.
It's not bad. I mean, she's doing pretty good with it.
That's good.
I have a 9-year-old son, and it's terrible. I'm
is
like,
it?
Do it again. Oh, it's terrible.
Yeah, but you know, girls have always had better handwriting than boys.
That's true.
It's sloppy. I'm like, take your time.
Take your time. But even that, if you don't know how to form a letter correctly because you haven't been, you can write as slow as you want.
That's true. And what bothers me is like,
you know,
big case, little case.
My concern is that we have a lot of stuff that's written, handwritten, books and things like that. What are you going to do with those?
Yeah.
True.
That's true. There we go. Thanks
for
calling in, John. And we had Cheryl, and Cheryl just disappeared.
Yeah, right. Cheryl.
No problem. So I'm thumbs up.
Yes, we need handwriting. But I understand the dilemma because we also need typing technology. And there, you know, there's got to be a balance.
So I remember.
But you never know. Technology, it could all crash one day. And then how would we communicate?
And that secret language.
You need the backup plan.
One of our staff members today realized that his son can't read cursive. And so now he was saying he and his wife have a secret code they write in. And that secret code is cursive. Because the child, he's only, in his defense, he's only in second grade, but he's not able to read it.
Yep.
It's just, it's an interesting topic, I think.
It is interesting. So what about you? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Mandatory. With accountability.
See, the second I hear mandatory, I shut down. I say, no, it shouldn't be mandatory.
Should not. They should have an option of teaching it or not.
Well, see, Mandy, when you say it like that with your lip curled up. You make me feel guilty. But I think about in high school, I had to take a typing class as well with no idea where technology would possibly go. We know technology has gone, has advanced so far from when I was in high school in that very special time.
Computer and typing is happening when they're three in daycare now.
Exactly. And they just have it in their hand all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there should be some skills. They should be able to communicate with a paper and pencil. But to say that cursive should be mandatory, I don't know that I can get behind that.
Okay.
Sorry.
Handwriting.
I hope I haven't disappointed you, Mandy, with my opinion.
Hey.
Hey.
To you. But- all right. Cursive. It's just kind of how we've always done it.
Wow.
Doesn't now necessarily mean it's right, though. Okay.
Okay.
So Katie's thumbs down. Mandy's thumbs up. What about you, Shannon? Thumbs up, thumbs down. Shannon's a thumbs up.
She's thumbs up.
Anthony, thumbs up. All right. You're on your own.
Yes, I am. Yet again, the statistical outlier.
Do we have a next call? Okay, great. All righty. So up next, we have Jill Campbell from Baker Ripley, and she's the managing immigration attorney. I had to pause for the music. How are you doing today, Jill?
Hi, I'm doing great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for joining us today. I know you have been a very busy lady these days, huh?
Yeah, I like to tell people I look frazzled and busy on the outside, but I promise on the inside I'm cool, calm, and collected.
That's good. Well, we saw you at a press conference a few weeks ago, and your appearance is very cool,
very,
calm, and collected.
That's right.
I'm very articulate. So, you know, Jill, tell us, give us the latest. I know a few weeks ago there were marches, there were press conferences saying stop separating children from their families. The Trump administration came back and said, okay, we're not going to separate them any longer, but there is still a zero tolerance policy in place. And that was a couple of weeks ago, right? So since then, what is going on nationally and particularly in Texas with these families?
So you gave a great background on the context there. The zero tolerance policy was really focused on the criminal prosecution of people who were encountered at around the border that did not have permission to enter the United States. And because of that, when you criminally prosecute someone, it was under it's a federal misdemeanor, because you're now in the custody of the U.S. Marshals and the federal government, they can't send a child to prison, right, to federal custody with you. And so they had to take your child, and your child was handed over to ORR custody, which is Office of Refugee Resettlement. And that's how family separation happened. So it wasn't necessarily a policy of family separation. It was a policy of zero tolerance, knowing full and well that it would lead to the separation and the forced separation of children from their parents. What we knew as advocates, and what I think the public is now later finding out, is that when they separated these children from the parents, there wasn't really any sort of tracking, or there wasn't really kind of an accountability of, okay, who's the parent? Where's the parent going? Who's the child? Where's the child going? And it's kind of was a combination of both cruel intentions and a cruel policy, along with a bit of an incompetence on behalf of the government. This is something that we've seen before, right, with the travel ban rollout and other things in the past. So now fast forward to a few weeks later, the criminal prosecutions have stopped because the president signed an executive order saying he wasn't going to separate families anymore. And you can't do one without the other. So had to get rid of both. But we still have what they were originally saying was 2,300 children who who had been separated, which is now looking like 3,000 children. In the meantime, a judge, in response to a lawsuit that was filed on behalf of these families, a judge gave the federal government a 30-day deadline to reunite these families, and a 14-day deadline to reunite the vulnerable age children, which is under the age of 5. That 14-day deadline, I think, is tomorrow. I think the 30-day deadline is July 25th or 29th. And the judge is ordering the reunification of the separated families. So the focus right now for advocates and for attorneys like me are the families that were separated by this policy and how, one, are we going to ensure that the adults have legal representation to fight their deportation, and two, how are we going to get these families reunited?
So can you see it? I'm sorry, Kate, but I know that you're on the ground with these families, Jill. Are they being reunited at the timely pace? Are they going to meet the deadline?
So the response on the ground from, you know, immigration officials was, well, we don't have any orders. We don't know what's going on either. So there hasn't been any affirmative steps, really, to reunite these families. Certainly the adults are still being detained because they're being placed in deportation proceedings, and they're being, you know, detained and deported like other immigrants who are in deportation proceedings. So they're not getting any special treatment. There's a few, I think, who have been released of the thousands, a few. But mostly these parents are still detained because they're fighting their deportation cases. There has not been many affirmative steps to reunite these families. The only thing the government did do was last weekend was start presenting the option for parents that, hey, you can sign this piece of paper here and sign your own deportation, and we'll reunite you with your child on your way out the door, meaning, you know, in order to be deported. Mm-hmm. So the attorneys on behalf of the federal government went back into court in front of that judge and said, look, it's going to be a lot of resources, and it's really difficult for us to actually reunite in this 30-day deadline. We need more time. We're not organized. We didn't really track everyone. We don't know how we're going to reunite families. And the judge's response over the weekend was, sorry, figure it out. So they're still on this 30-day deadline, and really day by day it's kind of anticipation of what they're doing or if they're going to do anything.
That is so unbelievable to think that it's escalated this far, and it still kind of feels like everybody's kind of just throwing their hands up and going, oh, that's not my problem to solve. Yet we have organizations like yours, Jill, that are stepping in to try and do whatever is possible to help. I know you guys typically, you mentioned that you help provide legal services for deportation defense services. What can you possibly do in this? What can Baker Ripley do in this situation to help these parents, say, that are given that piece of paper that say, you can have your kids back if you sign here and just see your way out?
Well, I mean, the first thing is telling them don't sign that paper.
Right.
Because these families are asylum seekers. That's a death sentence. I mean, going back to your home country, and that goes to show you how much this family separating someone from their child, you know, that they're like, I'll take deportation. I can't be separated from my child anymore. The first group of parents that our cohort of attorneys met with in detention centers had been separated from their children on May the 23rd. So this is a long time that they've been separated from their children. Mm-hmm. So the first is don't sign that paper. If you want to fight to stay here, then we'll get you pro bono representation. If not through us, then through a partner agency. And we're so fortunate that, you know, multiple agencies have stepped up. It's about helping, you know, in immigration deportation proceedings, you're not entitled to a free attorney. So you have to pay for one on your own, or you have to try to find a pro bono. So the biggest need is in ensuring that each of these parents has pro bono representation so that they feel like that their civil rights, due process rights, human rights are being fought for at the court level, and so that they can kind of have comfort knowing that there's someone who's going to help them fight their deportation. Prolonging this process so that they can also at least find their child, connect with their child via phone, know where their child is and how their child is doing while here in the United States. So that's the biggest need right now. And I think as we get closer to that 30-day deadline, we're looking at different ways that we can go into court and force the federal government to reunite these families. If they're not reuniting these families after the 30-day deadline, they're technically in violation of this federal judge order. So, you know, there's going to be some interesting legal things coming out of this.
I think there's going to be a lot of interesting legal things coming out of this.
Yes.
And it's complicated,
it
right?
Is.
And Jill, earlier we were talking about, and I know we have like, a minute left to discuss this, but we were talking about how resettlements in the U.S. have dramatically decreased, even though the refugee resettlements have dramatically decreased, even though the refugee population has increased.
Worldwide continues to
and increase. How that is different than asylees. Do you have any comments on how the population has increased, however resettlement has decreased? Briefly.
So really the way to look at that is what's the grant rate of asylum in the United States? It's really low here in Houston. We have one of the lowest grant rates for asylum, both out of our courts and our affirmative asylum office. Your chances of winning asylum here in Houston are really, really low. And then Jeff Sessions, actually, with this case that he referred to himself called Matter of AB, is going to reduce the grant rate of asylum even greater, because he basically says you're the victim of horrific domestic violence or gang persecution, that's not protected under asylum laws. And he actually has the authority to single-handedly declare that on behalf of the United States. So winning asylum is more and more difficult. Again, the need for good, effective pro bono attorneys.
There we go. All right.
I was going to say, that sounds like one of those many pieces of legislation that could come out of that. Maybe a little more balance of power. For a situation like this.
All right, Jill. So it is Final Four at 54. This is an opportunity for listeners to get to know you. So we have four questions. First one is, what was your favorite toy to play with as a kid?
Oh, my goodness. Any book.
A book. Reader.
And when you were a kid, what did you want to be as you were growing up?
Oh, hands down, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was my role model.
Hello.
Since I was in kindergarten.
You're almost
hands
there.
Down.
Hands down.
There we go. I love
hands
the conviction.
Down. Easy one.
And what was your favorite book to read as a child?
Oh, my goodness. That one's more difficult. I'm Canadian, and anything from a Canadian children's author. Robert Munsch is one of them. And my aunt, who is a Canadian teacher, indoctrinated me into Canadian writers.
Very nice. I love that. And what about your favorite movie? Or did you always have your nose in a book?
Oh, my gosh. Love Actually is always something that lifts my spirit.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a sweet one. Feel good.
It is.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Jill, thank you so much for all that you are doing. I know that you have been paddling really hard in the water, keeping your head above the water and helping so many families. So we appreciate you, and we'd love to have you back in the near future for more updates.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
All right, take care.
Bye, Jill.
All right,
thank
bye-bye.
You. Katie McConnell.
It's been awesome.
It's been fun. Thank
what
you
What a great
so
hour.
That's right. For more facts and information on children, visit us at childrenatrisk.org. Follow us on Twitter and listen in every Monday morning for commentary of activism and children during the KPFT morning news. You can like us. I want to thank Don. I want to thank Shannon. Hug your kids, and we'll see you next time on Growing Up in America on Pacifica Radio.
Human trafficking is modern-day slavery, and it happens in our own communities. Victims can be any gender, age, or race. Join the Department of Homeland Security's Blue Campaign to learn how to recognize and report this heinous crime. Visit our website at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. That's www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. Your second look could be their second chance. KPFT Houston.
KPFT's local station board meeting will be held Wednesday from 7 to 10 p.m. at Montrose Center, 401 Brainerd Street. Public comment is allowed from 8 to 8:30. For more information, call 713-526-4000 or go to kpft.org.
Mr. Ray. music for you.